For the week of August 23rd, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 17, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Joining us this week is Ann Thompson from Thompson on Hollywood, which is now a part of the IndieWire network of blogs. I don't know, do they call it a network of blogs, Ann?
Yes, they do. Yeah. I mean, technically, it's housed on their site, and they have a network of blogs, but we have a real partnership. So they're sort of invested in me, and I'm invested in them. It works. It's the sense that we feed each other's success, in other words, which is the whole concept.
Well, I know there was a lot of applause, let's say, when it was announced that you would be taking Thompson on Hollywood from Variety to IndieWire. Everybody thought that was the perfect place for Thompson on Hollywood and yourself to be, including myself. You can find the blog at blogs.indiewire.com/Thompson on Hollywood. And I have to say, since you moved, the number of posts has skyrocketed.
Well, you know, I'm starting over, really, you know, although I have my Twitter followers and my Facebook followers and people who are just moving over, but it's, you know, you have to build up the content and you have to build up the traffic, and all of that requires frequent posting. But, you know, on another level, it's just, I'm free to do, you know, whatever I want. And they're so indie focused that I can be their Hollywood play. And that works really well. I think that was part of the concept.
Yeah, it does seem that way, that they do the indie filmmaker side and you do the Tinseltown Hollywood side. And speaking of Twitter, you can be found at AK Stanwyck on Twitter. That's AK and then STANWYCK.
That's what I picked.
Is that a tribute to Barbara Stanwyck?
It is indeed. Thank you very much. And it's sort of my, you know, it's sort of my online, you know, my nom de plume.
Well, no better model than Barbara Stanwyck. She seems cooler the more movies I see. She's just terrific.
And speaking of Twitter, we're going to have a couple of stories about Twitter, one of which you mentioned in one of your posts, Anne. We're going to talk a little bit about box office and Avatar and Paramount's reshuffling of their schedule. And then, of course, we have to touch on Redbox at some point during the episode. We might get into a little bit of a remake watch, since a number of remakes were announced this week. Before jumping right into some television news, especially Dancing with the Stars announced their new lineup. We have some music news coming from Radiohead. And then, of course, as always, we close out with Inside Baseball and some reader email and voicemail. But first up, as always, is box office. And this week, Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino's movie, made $37.6 million on 3,100 screens. The budget was $70 million. And as we discussed last week with David Poland, the Weinsteins, I guess, are doing a little bit of a victory lap this week after all the bad publicity they got last week.
This was very, very good news,
I think, for everybody in the industry.
Yes, because the movie wasn't expected to do this well. It was perceived, you know, it didn't get the greatest reviews in the world. And it played on a global scale. It didn't fall. It held. It meant that it played well for the people who went to see it. So that gives it a few weeks of life, and that's wonderful news.
Well, I know you saw it twice because I read your blog, and you decided to skip the premiere.
I saw the first version in Cannes, and I thought it needed a little bit of work. It had been rushed into the festival, and Quentin himself was anxious to get back to the editing room and make some tweaks, and he did. And I thought the second version was much, much better, more smooth and glossy and really fun, especially when you know what you're getting into. And I think that that's the difference. The people who went to see the movie had read a lot about it, and they knew what they were getting. I don't think they were in for any kind of surprise.
Well, I saw it in Cannes too, as did Michael, but now you make me want to go out and see it again.
Oh, it's definitely better than the Cannes version.
Well, here's my question. I had no desire to see this movie at all. It looked like a really boring war movie. But a guy that I know saw it, and he loved it, and he said that he thought I would love it too because there are some really good female characters in it.
That's true.
In fact, the best character of all, Shoshana, she carries she sort of carries the through line. It's more about her than it's about Brad Pitt.
Well, they certainly are not marketing that this week.
I'm sure that's true. And women like him, and women went to the movies. The 42% of the audience was women, which was a big surprise.
Well, I've said this several times on the podcast, but I believe they should call it Inglourious Supporting Characters, because really, Brad Pitt is front and center in the marketing campaign, but he really is a minor part of the film.
But he is the way people like him these days. Everybody keeps saying to me they like him as someone who does comedy, and that is what this is. It's more comedy than, you know, there's a tone to the movie which is very consistent and makes it fun. It's not to be taken too seriously.
And this, of course, is Quentin Tarantino's biggest opening weekend by far. It's also a really big opening weekend for Brad Pitt. I mean, he has the Ocean's 11 movies, but those also star George Clooney, Matt Damon, Julia Roberts, and a cast of thousands. And then he had Mr. and Mrs. Smith with Angelina Jolie. On his own, the only movie he's had similar to this is Troy. This is, you know, a really big opening movie for him. Almost all of his movies make less than $200 million worldwide, so he is not the huge worldwide star that you might think he is. And this could be a, you know, the fact that they were able to piggyback this movie on him and open it so strongly and potentially do really well with a movie that, again, is in German and French and 8 other languages with subtitling is really remarkable. I think it's sort of a breakthrough for him.
Well, that's sort of interesting because he clearly is an international star. He's on all the tabloids. I mean, people certainly know who he is. But yeah, with the exception of like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and obviously Inglourious Basterds, I can't think of the last movie that he headlined at all, whether it did well or not.
He did pretty well in another ensemble, which was the working title comedy from the Coen brothers last summer. That did quite well. That did much better than anyone expected. I think his career is actually to be emulated. I think he learned a lot from George Clooney. I think it makes more sense to try and mix things up and do quality work than to try to sell out to the studios every time. And it works out better in the end.
And also, as you get older, doing ensembles is probably a better idea. Otherwise, you end up with, you know, Harrison Ford's career.
But he also came out very well with Benjamin Button. You know, that did fine for him.
That's true. That little movie didn't do too bad.
Another little movie that's not doing too bad is District 9, although, Michael, it did not have the legs that I thought it would. It made $18.9 million this past weekend to come in at second place. It dropped off 50%. Its total to date is $73.4 million, and for a $30 million movie, that's not bad. I mean, it's made close to $74 million in North America alone.
That's a respectable hold.
But I love the fact that it's down 50% because I just loathed this movie.
The backlash has begun.
I don't get it.
It was overhyped. I mean, the way everybody was talking about it was like the second coming. And I've gotten a lot of tweets actually this weekend from people going, I didn't think it was that good. But I did. I loved the movie. I thought it was extraordinarily well done.
Okay, why?
It takes you, I like this kind of documentary style filmmaking that takes you right into the thick of things and, you know, makes it very real. And just on a technological level, what they did with the aliens, making them interface with the humans in such a realistic way that you're not even questioning it, that those are all CG characters running around. I just jumped into that world and got lost in it and never knew what was going to happen. It was totally unpredictable to me, which is unusual these days. And this guy who I've never seen before, who's never been in a movie before, carried it very ably. And you ended up caring about the aliens and rooting for them to get away. And I was very impressed with this.
We should mention, of course, that it is not a documentary. It's a kind of pseudo-documentary. It's a mock documentary.
Right.
Yeah, well, documentary style is what you said. I agree with that. Yeah, I think that might be why, actually, I didn't like it.
Well, it's a little bit icky. I mean, for most women, this movie is incredibly intense, I would argue. I mean, it was hard for me to sit through.
I actually liked that. I liked all the violence because finally something was happening. Otherwise, to me, it was just people, like, whining. I hated the lead character. He was like Michael Scott from The Office, but, like, even more annoying. And the fact that I had to care about an alien was interesting, okay, but for the most part, this to me was just another buddy movie.
I didn't look at it as a buddy movie. It wasn't
a buddy movie. Him and the alien.
No.
48 hours in space. Well, not in space since they're on Earth, but sci-fi 48 hours.
Die Hard in a district.
No. My big argument with this movie is that it was very original and that we all need, we were and so, by the way, is the Tarantino. And it's good when movies like this do well. It's good for the whole industry because it sends the message that you don't have to make a big toy movie every time.
A movie that I did not think would hold as well as it's holding is G.I. Joe, The Rise of the Cobra, which made $12.5 million. I mean, it's dropped off another 44%, but to date, it's made $120 million. So it looks like it's going to make back its budget of $175 million.
Well, that's the message that Hollywood is listening to, unfortunately, because all those remakes you mentioned earlier are going to come as a result, you know, of Transformers. They're going to say, aha, this is the secret. We can do this. This is the safe play. And they'll just throw all their money at this kind of movie instead of anything that might be a little more adventurous.
Right. Although if it makes $175 million back in box office or $200 million back in box office, that doesn't necessarily account for any of the marketing budget. That $175 million is a production budget, and they probably spent another $100 million marketing the thing. Now, mind you,
luckily, they're going to get the toys.
Yes, and they're going to get international, and they're going to get DVD, and they're going to get video rental. So it's a moneymaker.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's more like they dodged a bullet. I don't think Paramount is going to be rushing out to greenlight a sequel to G.I. Joe. I think they got sort of lucky and they're squeaking up to 150, 160 million. It's not a big success. It's just not going to be a flop.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised if they were already readying a sequel.
I would agree with that.
I'm afraid you're right.
That's kind of Paramount's, M.O.
They might not have Steve Summers on it. That would be my argument. I mean, the guy is terrible. He's one of the hack directors of all time.
Oh, God.
I think people are finally realizing that. Well, a movie that's definitely not a flop is Julie and Julia, which made another $9 million this weekend to come in fifth place, and it's made close to $60 million thus far, which is pretty good for a $40 million movie.
Well, if Will Smith is the leading male star in Hollywood, Meryl Streep is the leading female star, and she's 60 years old, and I say huzzah to that.
Yeah, good for her.
A couple of episodes ago, maybe it was last week's episode, episode 16, where we mentioned that Meryl Streep is having old people sex in her next
That was
movie.
Last week.
Yes.
Can we say middle age?
It's complicated, Sperling. It's complicated.
Well, a side note for me is that, well, two side notes. Shorts opened this week, Robert Rodriguez's most recent film. It made $6 million to come in sixth place. And Harry Potter continues to be in the top 10. It came in eighth place. It's made $290 million in North America to date, which explains why they keep making those movies.
Okay, and I have to do my own side note, which I think Michael will join me on, Bandslam Rocks.
Yeah, Bandslam.
Any idea how much it made?
Bandslam made just under $900,000. It's made $4.4 million. It came and went, but it's this tiny little movie from Walden, who did the Narnia movies, and they're sort of a family label indie filmmaker, and they can't seem to open any movie other than the Narnia films, and even the second one didn't do well. Bandslam came out, it disappeared, but every review I read said, you know what, this is a pretty good little movie. And then Karen saw the movie and said she liked it a lot, and I went and checked it out, and it actually is a smart teen flick. Any movie that begins with the line "Dear David Bowie" is going to be okay by me, and I'm sure people will discover it a little bit on video.
Well, there was an article too about Summit, which released the movie, which also released Twilight movies and Sex Drive earlier this year, and there was an article about it like last week about how they basically mucked up the marketing for Bandslam and marketed it as something that it wasn't, and of course they also put Vanessa Hudgens in it from High School Musical, which completely, in my mind, nullified the whole thing. She was lucky to keep up with her people.
Wait a second. A Hollywood film that's marketed improperly? Since when does that happen?
Yeah, I know. But it was just interesting. It was on Nikki Fink's blog about how some insider, Summit insider, wrote that it had been messed up. The marketing, they mismarketed it. I know. That's not a news story, but being that my sister had a client in Sex Drive and sort of felt the same, I thought that was interesting.
And you said something that was very interesting when you were talking about Inglourious Basterds. You said it didn't drop off. Now, normally during a first weekend, people aren't worried about drop off because nobody has had a chance to talk to their friends at work yet. However, thanks to Twitter and Facebook, it looks as if movies like Bruno and funny people are dropping off from Friday night to Sunday night. And they'll make their biggest gross on a Friday, and then it'll drop off 50% Saturday and Sunday, which is very uncommon. And this week in the Washington Post, a story was published called "Twittering May Have Impact at the Box Office," and it seems as if the studios are beginning to learn with instantaneous feedback about their movies, not to from person to person, but from person to the masses. So one person who has 1,000 followers says, "Hey, I really enjoyed Inglourious Basterds," might actually convince 20 people to go see it. Likewise, the reverse is true.
I absolutely believe there is a Twitter effect, but I think that the Twitter effect is not just Twitter. I think it's everybody on the internet. It's Facebook, it's MySpace, it's text messages. My daughter doesn't use Twitter. She's 19. Most of her friends don't use Twitter. And so I think they've just been texting each other on their phones the whole time. Anyway, that's the same thing, finally. We're talking about the Twitter effect, but it's not just Twitter. But it is huge, and it is having an impact. And Bruno and G.I. Joe and films that opened really big dropped quickly. And I think that it's having, what it does is it speeds everything up. It makes it fast so that the studios cannot count on buying an opening weekend now. The word gets out much, much faster if a movie really doesn't play.
That is correct. And the Weinstein Company, according to the Washington Post, and this is a quote, has done that, has used Twitter big time for the Friday release of the Quentin Tarantino Brad Pitt World War II epic Inglourious Basterds. The company packed a screening at San Diego's Comic-Con with people who won access via Twitter. It also staged, quote, the first ever red carpet Twitter meetup during the movie's premiere at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, generating celebrity tweets, including Sarah Silverman's, "The film just made me smile forever," and Tony Hawk's "Another Tarantino classic." And this was an important, the important part of this paragraph, in my opinion. They finish it by writing, "Twitter has broadened the reach of bloggers and other aspiring opinion makers," and I would have to say that is absolutely true.
And I think it actually, my argument is that it also makes critics more powerful again, that it's possible for critics to, for their stuff to get out more and more quickly if they use Twitter. I mean, Roger Ebert is the great example of someone who's just got it, not Twitter per se, but an enormous internet following, and where they're checking everything that he writes. And so he has a bigger effect. But the other thing that the Weinstein thing represents is the idea that the studios are going to try to manipulate this. And my feeling is that the mass of authentic, real reactions to things, this sort of global word of mouth phenomenon, is going to absolutely swamp and bury any kind of attempt by the studios to manipulate this. And that if the Weinsteins got an effect, I mean, in other words, I don't think that the Twitter effect was about the Weinsteins manipulating Twitter. I think it was that the movie itself played well, and people responded that way.
I think social media is making brands and studios kind of honest again. And if the brand is bad, if the movie sucks, people won't go.
I am so pleased by this, because I heard a story this week about a studio executive who thought he was like revealing this extraordinary secret to someone and said, "Do you realize that we're actually going to have to make movies good now?" I was like, they
it's
get
so
it.
It's so sad, but so true. Thank God.
It's over.
But I agree with Anne, though. I think Twitter's just one factor in this whole, texting and cell phones. It's just it's a force multiplier, because you can reach so many more people. But we've seen movies drop from Friday to Saturday before. And when people can get on their cell phones and their text and their Twitter and their Facebook and their blog and let everybody know right away, it's going to happen quicker. You know, word gets out quicker. But Twitter is just a cute way of talking about what's been happening for a while with technology.
But even the wrong word can get out quicker. I mean, there was some rumors circulating earlier this week that Robert Pattinson from the Twilight films, the young heartthrob, had died. Obviously, the news was not correct, and it spread like wildfire on Twitter.
Now, I didn't hear this. How did he supposedly die?
It's not true, because he's a vampire. He can't die.
Okay, Michael, you need to put the books down now.
But Eddie Murphy, there was a rumor about him too. I mean, there, you know, stuff like this keeps but it gets quashed quickly also.
Yes, that is
true. I mean, Jeff Goldblum dies all the time, right?
Exactly. And those Richard Gere gerbil rumors keep coming back. It's amazing.
I don't know.
How many years has that been going around?
Steve Zaitchek over at The Hollywood Reporter on the Risky Business blog is calling Inglourious Basterds the first true Twitter success story. He kind of discounts District 9 because, quote, it benefited from strong word of mouth before it went into the theaters. But
I think he was played by the Weinsteins. I don't understand he quotes various people that he picked up on Twitter, you know, but it's anecdotal. I don't understand what the evidence is that this had a remarkable effect on this particular movie.
I think a lot of people will feel that the Weinsteins played them. I mean, they were in every newspaper last weekend about how their studio is on the brink of disaster. And then this weekend, their movie makes $38 million and they're saved again and they're doing a victory lap.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, I think that Twitter, which we've all been saying, it's not Twitter, it's social media. But I wouldn't be surprised if the Weinsteins planted this, because you mentioned the word Twitter and you look cool.
Well, I know that Anne uses Twitter. You use Twitter really effectively. AK Stanwyck, by the way, if you want to follow.
It's a delivery mechanism for me, but I am getting a little more comfortable with, so that when I blog post, it just automatically goes to Twitter, so people get the blog post. But what I am starting to do is to communicate more with the people that I'm you know, sort of hanging out with there. But I use it really to pick up material. That's what's most effective about it, is to find other stories early and get them very quickly.
That's true. It's become the new RSS reader.
And, exactly.
And what I do is I use Google Reader, and I share my links with whoever wants to follow. And what I've done is I've created an RSS feed to the Showbiz Sandbox Twitter account, so that interesting stories that I tag with a specific tag actually flow through to Showbiz Sandbox. And I don't abuse the privilege, and I don't abuse, you know, I don't send 300 messages a day, but, you know, like five different stories that are interesting. A lot of them actually this week came from Thompson on Hollywood.
I thank you.
And actually, one of the stories that I was really just on fire on Twitter and other social media outlets this week was Avatar. On Monday, 20th Century Fox started to give away tickets to a 16-minute preview of the next James Cameron film, which it will be in 3D. And I guess this preview was not only done in 3D, but also on IMAX. And
if you were in the right theater.
If you were in the right theater, which that's, yes, that remains to be seen how many theaters actually sold out. Fox, as you mentioned in your story, Anne, claimed that all of the tickets were booked, but not necessarily all of the people showed up.
Not at the theater I was at. I don't know. Did you go?
I did not go because I'd seen the footage twice before.
Me too, but I wanted to see it in the big IMAX 3D, you know, and I just was, it was incredible. It was amazing to just dive into that enormous screen and dive into that extraordinary Pandora world, which is all CG and luminescent, and you know, it may be technically what you would call animated, but I loved it.
Now, Michael, did you get a chance to see the Avatar footage?
First, I watched the trailer online, and then when I went to see X Games 3D, which opened and closed this weekend, I got like three trailers in 3D, including Alice in Wonderland from Tim Burton, which looked awesome, and Avatar, which I was really excited because when I watched it online, I thought, well, I don't really know what it's like because it's not in 3D. And then I went to the movie theater, and unexpectedly, I got to see it in 3D. It wasn't on IMAX, but it was on a regular screen. It was definitely more involving, but I still wasn't blown away. I think my reaction was like a lot of people that got quoted in stories. I went, huh, that's interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing the whole movie. But you two were blown away when you saw the 3D effect in the 16-minute section, so I'm wondering more what it was like that was so revelatory or different for you.
Well, for me, it was the fact that for once, somebody actually got live-action 3D right. They really knew how to shoot it, and it was an advance of the 3D that had come before it, as opposed to just being another 3D film. Certainly, the fact that some of the footage, once they get to Pandora, which is like either the planet or the location where the film takes place, the fictitious location, it is all CG, and some of it looked so real, it was hard to tell the difference.
It's just that when it's 3D, the immersive quality is even greater, and you just feel like you're falling into this other world, especially when it's the entire 3D CG environment. The movie is both. I mean, it's you go back and forth between the space station and live action characters, a little bit like The Matrix, you know, where they fall into this other world. But I'm counting on Cameron to be the good storyteller that he always is, and my guess is that he will pull people in, and that online trailer was not a very good way to introduce the movie.
Yeah, I didn't like the trailer. I was, of course, bored.
Well, 4 million
it made
people.
It made me think of Dark Crystal. But do you think this is like 3D, as in the introduction of color or sound?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a huge advance. And also performance capture, as opposed to what you get when you go to a Bob Zemeckis movie like Beowulf or Polar Express, which I personally think is very, and his new Christmas Carol, which I saw some footage at Comic-Con, it's very stiff and kind of sort of, I don't know, it just looks like a moving illustration. There's something very lunky about it. This was very fluid, and you could see the rippling facial muscles, the expressions of the actors underneath on Avatar. The characters were very, very lifelike in that way, and I think they've got closer to making that performance capture thing, which we all know from Gollum or King Kong, working in a much more human way.
Well, if the trailer, which does not show most of that, was not good enough, 4 million people streamed it on Apple's website, as you mentioned, and breaking the prior record of $1.7 million views set by Star Trek. So if that trailer is not good, they should try and fix that as soon as possible.
Well, I think the curiosity factor is the key here. That many people were curious to see it, even if they didn't like it. So I think the question is really going to be, how much interest are they going to build up in this event on December 18th, and how many people are going to go check it out? And I'm going to argue that the lure of the new will prevail.
Huge. I think this is a huge success. That was 4 million people the first day. More people have continued to download the trailer. Plus, let's remember, they got hundreds of thousands of people to go to a movie theater and watch basically an extended trailer. They went online, they tried to get tickets, then they went to the theater and they sat there and watched an extended trailer for a movie that comes out, you know, 4 or 5 months from now. That's pretty amazing.
That's a good point, Michael, because you mentioned that they went online and tried to get tickets. I tried to get tickets. However, the site crashed on the first day because demand was so high. I do like the way, Anne, you mentioned, or the way you described it. You said Cameron is selling the concept of this guy, Jake Sully, played by Aussie actor Sam Worthington, going on a fantastic mission to another planet, Pandora, where he becomes one of the natives, in effect, and falls in love. It's Last of the Mohicans meets Dances with Wolves in the future on sci-fi steroids. Guys will love this, and there's romance for the girls, too. I mean, they should have you writing the production notes.
Uh-oh, I'm getting too gushy. I just, let me put my cards on the table. I am an unabashed Cameron buff, and I have been from the beginning, and I just think he's, you know, he could be, you know, not the nicest guy to work for sometimes, very demanding and all that, but the guy, one of the reasons I love him and I like Peter Jackson for the same reason is that they actually want to please the audience. They want to give them something. They want, you know, they're not artists. They hang on to it. They hang on to their vision, but they also want to give people a great time. And I think that sometimes Hollywood loses track of the combo of those two things, where you're trying to be great and you're trying to give people a great time at the same time.
Well put. I totally agree. And I think that was part of my problem with some of the movies you've talked about earlier, like District 9, to me, gave the audience nothing. I thought that was all artiste. But yay, I'm glad to know that somebody like me, who kind of likes popular stuff, is to be respected.
You're the boss.
Yeah.
Don't tell her that. Please don't tell her that.
Hey, Michael, you wanted to talk about X Games, which is a movie I don't think I've even heard of.
Me neither.
Well, very quickly, at the very bottom of the box office list is X Games, which opened to $800,000 by Disney. It's X Games 3D, the movie. I was totally excited by it. Box office profits predicted it would only gross $2 to $3 million. In fact, it grossed $800,000. It completely collapsed. It seems like a no-brainer to me. A 3D movie version of the annual X Games events, which are, you know, huge rating draws on ESPN and are really jaw-droppingly amazing. These guys do stunts that you just can't believe they're doing on skateboards and motorcycles and motocross and bicycles and cars. And they blew this in about eight different ways. It should have been an easy moneymaker. Young guys going to see a 3D movie with stunts, life-defying stunts on skateboards. But instead, they filmed last season and they didn't release the movie until after this season's X Games. So it seems incredibly old hat. And they also made a movie that's sort of a quiet, thoughtful documentary with guys sitting on porches and profiles of people. And it would have made a nice preview to the new season on television. But when you're seeing it at the movie theaters, I want to see all the dangerous stunts in 3D. And in fact, you could probably condense all the stunts down to about 20 minutes that are in the movie. And half the time, they show them in slow motion. So they blew this in about eight different ways. It should have been an easy moneymaker for Disney / ESPN, and they blew it.
Lame.
I can tell you that working in the motion picture exhibition technology space, which means that I work on the technology that presents movies, digital cinema technology is what that's my day job, if you will. I had no idea this film was even in the works or being released. And I can tell you every 3D film being released from now until the end of time, because this industry, the motion picture exhibition space, follows it so closely. And I had no idea this was being released.
If nothing else, they should have released it like a month and a half ago, right before the new X Games. You know, why wait until after this year's X Games? You know, if they couldn't rush it out and get it out a few weeks after last season because of editing and all that, then they should have released it as a preview to this season. At least it would have been a precursor and banging the drum for the new X Games. Instead, they waited till after it was over. It was just poor scheduling, the wrong type of movie to make. You know,
who every released year this?
Disney. Disney, ESPN. And every year when the show is on ESPN for like 4 or 5 nights, I tape the highlights and make like a 20-minute reel and show it to people who have never seen X Games, and their jaws drop and they go, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing that. And I expected an hour and a half of that in the theater, and instead I got, you know, nothing.
I suspect that the people who are making money from this in its other manifestations are protecting their profits there, and probably gave the people who were doing the documentary less access and less exposure than they would have liked. It smacks of that.
It's a good guess, but they had total access. They had every star that they wanted. They went with them to their home and their practice. They had all the access in the world. And I think a successful 3D movie would have just expanded the reach of X Games and, you know, increased their profits.
Well, right. That's actually a very good segue to Redbox, although you had a story on Paramount pushing Shutter Island to February, and on the big picture, Patrick Goldstein's column in the Los Angeles Times, he mentioned that Paramount was backing up the Vantage dump truck and dumping all of these Vantage movies, such as, what was that movie you saw last week that you hated, Michael? The Goods.
The Goods. Oh, yeah.
They opened that with a back. They had some backing for that. But the Mark Peace Experience is the one that they put out in like 10 theaters and dumped. and they have there's, I think, one more left. But, you know, John Lesher's gone. Basically, the guy who founded Paramount Vantage and then moved over to Big Paramount when he saw that Paramount Vantage was going down the tubes with a new economic situation there, he's not there to protect his babies anymore. And so there's nobody to take care of them.
Well, I'm going to put in a big plug for Amy Israel here, who was also at Vantage and who did a bulk of the work there and didn't get a whole hell of a lot of credit for it.
She was terrific.
Yeah.
Carriers, starring Piper Perabo and Chris Pine, is the other film that they're just kind of dumping in August or early September. But Paramount seems to be playing with its release schedule. It pushed Shutter Island, which is the Martin Scorsese thriller that
starring Leonardo DiCaprio.
Right, that's where I was headed. That they pushed it to February, and everybody was talking about this as a prime awards candidate.
You have to assume, and I did try to get some info out of a number of different people. The sense I get is that they didn't have confidence in the movie performing at the level that they would want it to perform, given what it was. And it seems like a thriller. It seems like a pretty scary, sort of moody thriller. And I've been hearing it compared to Cape Fear. And so they basically are cutting their losses in terms of not spending the money. They have a budget issue. They're trying to get their budget met for this year. Not spending the money, not having a disappointment. If it isn't an Oscar contender, then they don't want to set it up as one and then put it back to February. But I just feel like there was so much positive buzz about the movie. Why couldn't they just open it? It's very strange.
It is quite shocking, especially because do you really want to piss off Martin Scorsese?
Well, they must have had made a deal with him. They'll come through for him in some other way. They're very close to him. I mean, Brad Grey is very close to him. So, you know, whatever. The movie's finished. It wasn't a question of giving him more time.
I like the way Brad Grey spun it, though. He said it's going to be a solid anchor to the 2010 season.
Well, you're laughing, but in fact, you need movies in January and February and March. You can't take off 3 months of the year, and I don't think it's an Oscar contender. I know Dennis Lehane is a terrific writer, but it doesn't look like an Oscar-type movie. I know maybe The Departed wasn't either, but this wasn't going to be up for, you know, this does not look like an Oscar movie. It looks like a perhaps commercial movie, which Martin Scorsese hasn't made a lot of. And I think in February, it'll be fairly alone. It'll have the field open to itself. It'll be the only prestige picture around. And I think the idea that if you put it in February, it's a dog is, you know, it's got to go by the wayside.
Well, I can tell you that the exhibitors in the U.S. are ecstatic because they need movies in February, like you said, Michael. And here they're going to have a Martin Scorsese movie that stars Leonardo DiCaprio. They couldn't be happier.
It's cheaper to open up in February than it would be in the fall season when it's going to be.
Yeah, they'll save a lot of money, and they'll certainly save a lot of money if they don't have to deal with an Oscar campaign.
True.
And there's a lot more clutter in the fall, just a lot more money to cut through it.
And there's less money these days thanks to Redbox. We talked about them last week. They are the $1 per night movie rental service that you can find in...
They've got one in my local grocery store at Vaughn's.
And mine too. And Sperling, you guys, unfortunately, this is Mike. I've got to duck out.
Yes, we should say that Karen is working on a big project over at Industry Nexus, and so she has to take off a little early today, so we will no longer have contrarian opinions for the remainder of the
episode. I'm sure Michael can take care of that for me.
Bye,
Karen. See you, Karen.
Bye.
So, Anne, you linked to a lot of stories about Redbox. What's your take on it, your personal take?
Well, I think it's an incredibly important story, and it's not as simple as everybody, you know, there's this sort of Patrick Goldstein, especially a lot of people are taking up this sort of, well, they're, you know, the studios that are fighting Redbox are the Napster, you know, it's like the old movie, you know, music wars where you're taking, you know, you're taking the wrong side, and, you know, there's a whole other argument that's going on in the media space about whether there should be firewalls put up, you know, and start charging for content with the new. And there's a whole school of people that say, you know, free, free, free. You just can't charge for content. And I'm stepping back a little bit and saying the studios really are relying on DVD sales as well as rentals in order to, you know, stay alive. And I'm not feeling sympathetic toward the studios exactly. They're still making a lot of money, and they're spending way, way, way too much money. But the point is that for them to suddenly, you know, have to do this dollar rental thing is really terrifying. And I do understand why they're trying to sort of stave off the inevitable. But the economy and the charts that are being shown of the Redbox trajectory, it's huge. I mean, the people are buying, you know, are renting these things in vast numbers. That's where the money is. So Lionsgate, Sony, they're going with it. And Warner's Universal are fighting against it. And it's going to be very interesting to see. They're trying to give it a window of like 30 days or 45 days before. And there's lawsuits flying. It's going to be a very interesting war going forward. But I do think the studios have some reason for concern. It's not just, oh, my God, we should be going with Redbox automatically.
The Rap.com story on this quoted Time Warner chairman Jeff Bukes as comparing Redbox to dollar movie theaters, the second-run movie theaters. And
I don't see it that way at all. I think it's a question of if you can charge you know, $14 instead of one, why wouldn't you want to get, you know, more of that share of the pie?
Well, and you mentioned that some studios are going to be delaying their release to Redbox. I know Warner Brothers said in October they will be dealing directly with Netflix and kiosk retailers rather than going through wholesalers, which were selling the discs, the DVDs, to the retailers and the kiosk retailers in the first place.
Right. So they basically are asking the wholesalers to wait a month or so before they supply their movies. And that's what the basis of the lawsuit that Redbox is filing is about. You know, they're saying they should be able to get those with everybody else, that this is not okay.
Well, and the lawsuit was upheld by Robert Kugler, a U.S. District Court judge from Delaware. He granted the dismissal of two of the three counts against Universal in the 10-month-old lawsuit, but denied Universal's motion to dismiss the antitrust claim altogether, according to the court's records. The two counts dismissed relate to copyright and tortious interference, the latter term implying an attempt to disrupt another party's business relationships, and the decision has both sides claiming victory in the ongoing battle, according to videobusiness.com.
Yeah, so each side is arguing that they have the right, you know, to go ahead and conduct their business as they see fit, and it's going to be interesting to see what the judges decide.
Well, Patrick Goldstein, as you mentioned in the LA Times, says that the studios are trying to hang on to their business model for as long as possible, but, and I quote here, they delay at their own peril. In this era where disruptive technology rules the earth, if you don't give the customers what they want, you will find yourself on one side of the river, while the person who's embraced the new business model is on the other side, where all the action is. The studios are deluding themselves if they believe they can hold off the widespread embrace of dollar-per-day DVD rentals, since if you can learn anything from the tumult of the internet era, it's that you can't fight the power of consumer choice. And Anne, you had a wonderful post on your blog about from Mint.com. It was a chart from Mint.com, which is a...
Yeah, that's where I got the real sense of how dramatic the rise of the use of Redbox really is.
Yeah, it showed that consumers are actually using that more and more over Netflix, over going to the movies. It was quite dramatic. I mean, it really showed where people are spending their money when it comes to DVDs and movies.
Well, the chart was a chart of the rise of growth. So, I mean, if I have a magazine and I go from one subscription to 10 subscriptions, I've increased my subscription by, you know, 1,000%. Whereas, you know, Time Magazine goes from 2 million to 2 million and 4. They look like their growth is much flatter. So I mean, it's a little misleading on the chart. But the main thing is the model that the studios are trying to protect is they're having a cut of the revenue stream. If Redbox gave them a cut of the revenue, they would be fine with the way Redbox does business. It's a perfectly reasonable way of doing business. It doesn't cheapen the DVD. And they have deals with Blockbuster and all the other video stores that they get a cut of the revenue from DVD rentals. And if they got that with Redbox, they would be perfectly happy with the way Redbox does business. But Redbox came up with a business model that doesn't involve having to give a cut of the profits to the studios, and that's what's making them angry.
Also, I can see from the studio point of view that this is where the dollar theater thing comes in. If you're in a big video store and you have displays and you have standees and you know, your product is being given nice placement, and so this is what they've, you know, managed to work out over the years, that's a good thing. These Redbox kiosks have nothing like that. You know, it's just a bunch of titles and that's it. So I can see why the studios are not enthralled by it.
Well, and to both of your points, I actually wrote a comment on your blog, Anne, that kind of went into the history of...
That was great. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. It was, you know, somebody basically said, well, why don't they get a cut, or why don't they go back to pricing videos for what's known as sell-through?
Rental.
Yeah, rental or sell-through. Yeah, well, rental, yeah. And, well, you know what? You could go to Anne's blog and read the comment, and you'll... I don't know why I'm...
You understand it a lot better than I do.
Well, I just happen to have worked in that field for a little while, and can I'm happy not to be working in that field anymore, that's for sure. But certainly the studios aren't making as much money anymore, and it does seem like they're trying to play it safe, which may be why they're making a number of remakes. I guess the biggest news remake of the week was The Yellow Submarine, The Beatles' Yellow Submarine, Robert Zemeckis is going to be remaking that. I just cannot understand that for the life of me.
He has a company, which is it has a deal at Disney, and it's a performance capture, you know, image motion, I think it's called.
Image Movers Digital.
Yes, and he's looking for projects to do there. And with Beatles Rock Band coming out in September, which is going to be huge, this will be a very commercial project for him, I think. At least assuming he delivers a better movie than the original.
And there's some talk that on September 9th, 2009, when Apple holds their big press, product release, that they're going to be announcing the Beatles are finally going to allow their stuff to be sold on iTunes, and they will have a special Beatles iPod. I don't know how true any of this is, but those are the rumors.
I hope so.
I can't see a remake of, that's a classic movie.
I don't hold Yellow Submarine in such high regard. I never thought it was that good. It was fun to look at for, you know, a while. And some of the music was from the other album. But you remember the original songs from Yellow Submarine weren't that great, really.
Yeah, that's true.
No, but it was packed with other songs, not just the songs from, you know, the new songs written for the movie were weak. And that was actually the first Beatles album I ever bought, sadly. I went to the store and I didn't know anything. And I said I wanted a Beatles album. And the girl steered me towards Yellow Submarine, which is the only Beatles album you could buy that would be close to sucking, because half of it is just instrumental music by George Martin. But I actually find the movie kind of sweet.
You got snookered.
I find it charming. I did get snookered, absolutely. But, you know, the Beatles, even more than Rock Band, the Beatles box sets of their stereo and mono versions of all their albums come out September 9th, which I've already pre-ordered and I'm very excited about. But, of course, Robert Zemeckis' movie won't come out for 3, 4, or 5 years. And
right.
I think it's a bit of a strange idea, but if you got the rights to the Beatles songs, you know, go right ahead.
Well, what it is, as Sperling was sort of heading in this direction, it's the new mantra, which is, you know, go with something established and branded and pre-sold and familiar, and you will get the audience to come. And that's what the studios are doing in droves. And even Catherine Hardwicke, who, launched Twilight, basically, now she's going to do a little Red Riding Hood, you know, movie. Maybe it's a gothic horror version, but it'll be, you know, that familiar global fairy tale. And, you know, Bryan Singer, Ridley Scott, the biggest directors in Hollywood are Steven Spielberg doing a remake of Harvey. They're all going back to the original stuff that once was original, but they're going to be leaning on something pre-established, and that's just the way it is.
Hasn't Hollywood always done remakes and sequels?
More than ever, the big studio directors are doing that. That's the thing. I mean, they used to be able to take the, you know, push the edge of the envelope a little bit and go off into the unknown. And you can just see by the deals that are getting made that they're having to do that too.
Last week, we mentioned that Bryan Singer would be remaking or working on Battlestar Galactica
in film form.
This week, it's announced that he's developing an Excalibur remake. And on Twitter, Production Weekly announced that Lionsgate is putting Baby back in the corner again. They're remaking Dirty Dancing. It's just, why would you remake that film? It's only 22 years old.
That's 100 years ago in Hollywood terms. Plus, the movie has made $1 gazillion on DVD, and the stage version is a huge hit in Canada and England. It's been playing for years on stage in London, and, it's making money.
But it's filled with 80s music.
Well, they would do new music, I imagine, just like I assume, you know, they'll have maybe some old songs. They'll use I've Had the Time of My Life, but I imagine they'll also use new songs, just like I assume Footloose would do the same thing.
And Fame, you know, that's the next one we have to look forward to.
And does anybody know? I assume they use, you know, one or two iconic songs, and then they use a bunch of new songs.
It's utterly new. Utterly new, unknowns, everything. It's hardly the same story at all.
No, but they use Fame, obviously. They use that song,
right?
Don't they?
Yes.
Yeah, I meant the songs. They use one or two of the same songs.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, speaking of songs and music, my segues today are just horrible, but I'll skip right into television. Dancing with the Stars, I know Karen's a huge fan. Michael, I know you also watch the show. I, of course, just try and shy away from all reality TV. They announced the new lineup for their ninth season, I guess it is. Celebrities that will be starring on it are Aaron Carter, who I guess is a musician, Ashley Hamilton, who used to be married to Shannon Doherty, although I don't know what else he's done, Macy Gray, the musician. I don't know why she's doing it. Her career's not washed up. Donny Osmond, Kelly Osbourne, Ozzy Osbourne's daughter, Maya, Melissa Joan Hart, model Kathy Ireland, former football player Michael Irvin, Joanna Krupa, who's also a model, actress Debbie Mazur, Mark Dacascos, who is a chef on Iron Chef, and Natalie Coughlin, who is an Olympic swimmer. She has 11 Olympic medals. But the most interesting person that is doing it is Tom DeLay, who used to be a Republican congressman and was indicted as a Republican congressman here in the United States. He was from Texas. I don't know what he's doing on that show, but he is going to appear as one of the contestants.
Do you watch the show at all, Anne?
No.
The funniest one to me is Macy Gray. She sticks out strangely. That's funny. Maybe she loves dancing, but it's definitely not people whose careers are washed up. That's the way it was maybe season one. But, you know, at this point, the show is so popular that you have people from all levels of, you know, celebrityness coming onto the show. So it's not like I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, or some other D-list reality show. This is, they get top people who are still quite active and can help your careers and take you, introduce you to a new audience. And, you know, it's just silly fun.
Tom DeLay, a politician? I mean, I know that they always try to throw one oddball.
Former politician.
He's a former politician. He was indicted on money laundering. And yet he can still be on this show. Apparently, though, if you kill somebody, you can't be on a reality show, because VH1 had some show where a murder suspect was, I guess, in the show, and he murdered his ex-wife or wife and dumped her body in a trash can in California somewhere and then escaped to Canada. And then I'm reading this morning in the newspaper, he wound up killing himself. VH1 had canceled the show previously.
Well, that's a depressing segue, but I could say as far as Dancing with the Stars, if they can have Tom DeLay, I'd love to see Barney Frank and see who they partner him with.
He's my hero.
Last year they had Steve Wozniak, yeah. The guy who founded Apple, or one of the guys who helped found Apple.
Well, you know, Dancing with the Stars also, just like So You Think You Can Dance and American Idol, they have big pop bands coming on and performing their latest song. It's just another way of getting your song out, which I think segues to the next item. You were going to talk about the music industry.
Yes, and actually it kind of touches on, Anne, what you were saying. This past week, well, I guess this is a story that's been going on for 2 weeks in some way. Radiohead had a song supposedly stolen and leaked onto the internet through BitTorrent. This was a song called These Are My Twisted Words. And then last week, they released the song for free on their website. They also released another song, which isn't getting as much publicity, called Harry Patch in Memory Of, which was a song released and written about the last World War I hero who passed away recently. The song is written, the lyrics of the song are completely Harry Patch's own words from an interview he did, which I thought was kind of interesting.
I actually downloaded the Radiohead thing when they did that initially, just for fun. And, you know, I came up with a very modest sum that I was willing to pay. And I think it's great that they've innovated this way. And it seems to be leading other people to follow suit.
Now, Anne, what you're talking about is you downloaded In Rainbows, their last album.
That's right.
Okay.
What did you pay for it?
$4.
Fair enough, absolutely,
because they didn't have to package it. Apparently, the average was much higher.
Yeah, the average.
It's a great album.
The average was about. It is a very good album, and the average was about $7. And you know, there's some talk that Tom York is saying that he doesn't want to cut another album, but that isn't really news when you think about it, because Tom York has been saying that the album format has been dead for years.
And are you saying that the model change here is that they're actually just doing individual songs now instead, and that's it?
Right, they're doing individual songs, or they're releasing like three or four songs at a time. The fact that they're giving them away for free, there's some question about that, because people are saying, well, it's one thing if you're only going to record three or four songs and release them digitally via your own website, and you're cutting out the record label, which, by the way, Radiohead does not have a record label. But it's another thing entirely if you're going to charge for that. Of course, everybody thought that Radiohead giving away their music effectively for free within Rainbows was going to make that album a disastrous failure. They made more money on that record digitally than they did from all of their other records combined, the digital sales, that is.
But the new model is that you make your money on the concerts anyway, right?
That's right. Well, and then the album was released on CD, and in its first week, it sold some astronomical amount of records. I believe it was the number one album that Radiohead had ever released.
Well, the new model is the old model. Bands in the 50s and 40s, 50s and 60s made their money on tour, and they put out singles. The albums were an afterthought, and an album is a great artistic form, and it's not going to go away. People are going to still create a 10 or 12 song suite that you want to listen to all at one time. But I think artists were trapped a little bit into ignoring the single and the EP, especially the single. And there are singles bands. Like Madonna is a singles artist. She doesn't need to craft an album. She could have great success by putting out a new single every few months and getting attention for it. Chris Isaak, Radiohead, if they're drawn to the single. This is just the way it was in the 50s and 60s. You put out a single, you tour, that's where you make your money. And with iTunes and the way people listen to music now, singles have more currency than ever. You know, they disappeared for 10 or 15 years. The record labels killed the single. You couldn't buy singles. You had to buy an album. They literally wouldn't release them, or if they did, they release them for a few weeks and then cut them out. So if you just wanted a song, a great song, you couldn't do it. And iTunes and the internet has brought that all back again, and we're right back to where we were in the 50s.
I don't listen to long albums anymore. I shuffle. I shuffle or I Pandora, and that's all about single cuts.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Well, you know, iTunes now is 25% of music sales in North America.
Mm.
It's the number one record store.
Oh, it is.
It's the number one.
Oh, I didn't know that.
iTunes is number one. Yeah, I mean, go to New York City. There are no record chains left. There's no Virgin. There's no HMV. There's no Tower. You can't literally. It's incredibly hard to walk into a store and buy a CD. It's very, very hard to do in New York City. And you know, other than Walmart, which doesn't have deep catalog, extrapolate that throughout the country. There just aren't record stores anymore.
I'm sure Discorama is still there in the West Village.
Yes, but you can't go in there and be able to find all the new releases in deep catalog. You can't, there's Discorama and there's J&R Music World, but the major record chains are all gone. And it's, you know, other than J&R, there's nobody with really deep catalog, and J&R is really strong in classical and jazz.
TechDirt.com was saying that Radiohead leaked the track onto BitTorrent all by itself, that it was them that leaked it. Then there's some controversy over whether they leaked it or whether it was stolen, and that they then decided to release it for free since it was already stolen and get the publicity. If that's the case, it certainly worked because we're sitting here talking about it.
And would you pay for, if you liked In Rainbows, would you buy a single from Radiohead? Or are they not one of your core artists? Is there somebody else?
You know, I actually sampled them. I mean, I just bought the whole record and enjoyed listening because I've always liked them on the radio. So it actually inspired me to buy an album, which I rarely do anymore. As you say, it just doesn't happen that often anymore.
But I bet part of the reason for you buying a whole album was the fact that you could pay $4 for it.
That was it. And to experiment and to see, you know, what that experience was like. But I do buy things on iTunes all the time. Sometimes I buy an album, sometimes I buy a single. I do it all the time.
For years, there was a Russian website called allofmp3.com that was shut down by, well, I guess the U.S. copyright, RIA. Yeah, the Politburo. It was in Russia, and they were getting around copyright in some weird way. And they listed every single new album on their website. And you would have to pay, but you would pay per song, and you'd pay like $2.50 for an album, or $3 for an album. No DRM, so no digital rights management. And I would go to that site, and I would download new artists that I wasn't familiar with. I'd listen to their music. Half the time, I'd go see them live. So I
see, that's really good for the business. That's good.
And I paid $2.50, $3 for the music. And, you know, it was digital only. I didn't get a CD, and, you know, it was at 192 kilobits per second, so it wasn't CD quality.
No matter how much you enjoyed the website, they were stealing. So, you know, if you want to argue for low-price CDs, support Radiohead when they do it legally. Support people when they put albums on iTunes on sale. They had like they put albums on sale for like $5 all the time. They'll put Moondance on sale. Every week they've got specials, and they've got, you know, unexpected things, really great albums, for really, really inexpensive money. They had Creedence Clearwater Revival Chronicles, a 20-track album for $5. And, you know, encourage that, but don't, you know, don't say it's a great business model to have somebody in Russia steal the music and sell it to you really cheap. You know, you might as well go on the street corner and buy bootlegs.
No, I guess what I'm encouraging is low-priced albums.
That's good.
He said he liked the experience of that kind of option, right. And he'd like to be able to do that again.
Right. To basically go.
Yeah, well, the nice thing is that iTunes provides that. When something is legal and easy to use, people will go to it, because you could steal any album you want, but people still go to iTunes and buy it legally because it's available and it's easy to do.
But the point is that Apple took that whole idea and did it in a much more aggressive and innovative way than the studios ever wanted them to do. Fought against
You're
it.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. They hated it. They fought it. They still hate them.
I know, because they won.
Well, if anybody's thinking of buying an album this week, a new album that comes out on Tuesday that I highly recommend is Willie Nelson's American Classic. It's his first official follow-up to Stardust, perhaps the best-selling album of his career and a landmark album of Willie Nelson singing standards. And he's doing standards again, you know, things like On the Street Where You Live and Angel Eyes. And it comes out Tuesday.
I love it
and
when
it's
he
just
does terrific. That. Nobody does it better. I'm ordering the album right now.
And, you know, that's how he began his career, with singing standards. And, there, you know, at the time, everybody thought, oh, he couldn't make it as a standard singer in a tuxedo. So he put on a cowboy hat and suspenders and he became a country singer. but I think, Michael, the only reason you're saying that and recommending that album is because he is now following you. Willie Nelson is following Michael Giltz, who joined Twitter last week. Michael, one of Michael Giltz's like 9 followers is Willie Nelson.
It's actually not Willie Nelson, of course. It's a PR firm promoting his new album. But when I Twittered on Saturday or Sunday that, you know, because the album's coming out Tuesday, and I just Twittered a line saying how great it was. Yeah, I got an email saying Willie Nelson is now following you, which I thought is great. But unfortunately,
I've got Jim Cameron only. I don't know. It's Jim effing Cameron following me now on Twitter, and I went in there and looked at it, and I really genuinely tried to figure out if it could possibly be him, because he's very anxious to sell Avatar, so it wouldn't be beyond the possibility that he's trying to figure this out.
But it's probably not him. Anybody that any account that would be his would have a little green check mark, a verified check mark, meaning that
is that how you know?
Yes.
Okay, I'll check.
And in my case, I'm just worried because now that Willie Nelson is following me, I'm afraid that the IRS is going to be following me too.
Well, that brings us to Inside Baseball. We have 2 stories, and we can pick among them. I think that Anne's Hollywood Health Report is more interesting than the Terminator drama, which you also wrote about, Anne. You wrote a really interesting post about what's going on in Hollywood with all the studios and the current state of their health as businesses and as...
Well, also just in terms of what kind of pressures are being placed upon them by their parent companies and the economy and what kind of duress the current management. Remember, most of these movie studios are just small parts of these enormous conglomerates, and so there's a lot of pressure on them just in terms of the bottom line, but... you know, they're not standalone, you know, except for, you know, MGM, which is very fragile at this point. So I put MGM and actually the Weinstein Co. at the top of the list of the most, you know, the most crisis, just because they're carrying so much debt that it's impossible to even imagine how they're going to be able to pay it back. And then there are a bunch of other studios that are just looking at, you know, performance issues in terms of having to prove that they shouldn't change their management. Like Universal's been under a lot of pressure because they've had such a tough year.
Because they released Land of the Lost.
Land of the Lost was just, but you know, they really didn't do well with the Sam Raimi movie, Drag Me to Hell, and you know, Public Enemies was a disappointment as well, and Bruno disappointed, and finally, and they had those earlier movies, State of Play, that didn't do well. So Duplicity. So I think yeah, you know, they're all on the edge of having to really, you know, score well if they're not going to be, you know, under some duress.
And oh, I beg your pardon. And does the threat level on the Weinstein Company change a little bit because of the strong opening weekend? Did they get a
and Universal? It helps Universal also. Inglourious. But now Wall Street Journal had a story which I have to sort of dig into and read more carefully. But it has a story suggesting that even if Inglourious Bastards does really well, they're still under a lot of pressure debt wise, and that's true.
Now was it the fact that MGM? I guess, replaced Harry Sloan as their CEO. Did that spur you to write this, or was it the Weinstein articles? What was the...
It was the two of them together, you know, that got me thinking, because you start to see a pattern as once, you know, Universal, there were some stories about them, too. You see the pattern of why these companies and how these companies are under extreme duress. I mean, Sony looks pretty strong, and Fox looks, you know, steady as they go. Warner's looks steady as they go right now.
And on the rise, you say, are DreamWorks, Oscilloscope, Summit, and Legendary. Legendary isn't that Joel Silver's company?
No. Legendary is Tom Tull, and it's a company that is basically based at Warner's, but what they do is they're sort of like... an investor they partner with the studios, and they've done Dark Knight and Watchmen and Superman, and the guy has a very comic book sensibility, and so far they've picked very, very well, and they're doing well. People like them, like working with them. It's a question with companies like that of plucking all your poker chips and putting them down on the right square, you know, the right number.
Yeah, I think I'm mistaking the Joel Silver thing, because I think their offices are right across from one another on the Warner Brothers lot, and
very close to each other, actually.
Yeah, that's what I.
Oscilloscope is a little tiny micro indie that's been founded by Beastie Boy Adam Yauch, and it is they did Wendy and Lucy last year, little tiny indie film. So they're picking up lots of documentaries, and everybody, you know, they're in a time when. The indie sector is under a lot of duress. They seem to be, you know, just plugging along and doing on a very small scale. They're the new sort of rising distributor.
Well, that article or that post, I don't know whether you call them articles when they're online, is, in my opinion, a great example of why you should go to Anne's blog, Thompson on Hollywood, every day. You should be there every day, because that was so concise and so brief. I mean, you could actually read this post in about 10 minutes or less, and you knew everything that was going on at the studios. It was perfect. and I like the little list. In crisis mode, MGM and the Weinstein Co. Experiencing upper management distress. Disney/Miramax. Lionsgate. Universal. Focus Features. And, you know, is that like upper respiratory distress? Or is that...
Heavy breathing.
Heavy breathing. Well... Last week, we ended our podcast by playing a voicemail. This week, we can end it by reading one of the emails that came in. And I believe, Michael, you have that.
Absolutely. We got a nice email from a reader. Patrick said, just wanted to write and say that last week's Showbiz Sandbox was by far the best podcast yet. And it feels like it is really hitting its stride and finding its form. You were helped by an excellent guest, particularly in the form of David Poland, who really contributed some original insights. And nice to have an East Coast flavor. More of him. You steered the topics and discussions nicely. That's obviously you, Sperling. And I did not mind the minor audio issues, as it felt more conversational, even though you were spread across the continent. You are creating something of lasting value, and I hope you will all keep at it. All the best, Patrick. So thanks for writing in, Patrick.
Well, and we do hope to keep at it, although I would say, what audio issues? I didn't...
Sorry if I contributed this time.
Oh, no, actually, you were just fine. In fact, we should thank you, Anne. You can find Anne's blog at thompsononhollywood.com, which will redirect you to blogs.indiewire.com/thompsononhollywood. And, of course, you can always follow her tweets at akstanwyck on Twitter. And I think, actually, I have to I don't know what happened, but for some reason, and you dropped off. I was following you, you were following me, and you dropped off. I had to refollow you. And then
I'll make sure that you're on there. And Michael, how do I follow you on Twitter?
Funny you should say. I just started Twittering. You know, Willie Nelson is following me, but it's only been a week now. And I'm at my name, Michael Giltz, MICHAELGILTZ. But I think Sperling will have it all in the show notes.
Yes.
Or you can always go to my website, michaelgiltz.com, where you can find links to me on Netflix and Twitter and Facebook and all that sort of stuff.
Cool.
And actually, you can also find Karen Woodward on industrynexus.com. And I'd give you her Twitter account, but I think it's kwoody3939, I believe. But I could be wrong with the 39 part. And so, Patrick, thank you for sending in an email. If you would like to have one of your emails read on the next episode or a future episode, you can send us email at dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can comment on the stories we talked about or send us feedback. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can go to the show notes, as Michael just mentioned, to get links to all of the stories in this episode or any of our episodes. You will find those links in the show notes for episode 17. Of course, that's also the place where you will find links to all of our social networking websites, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, you name it. If you want to send us news stories, you can do so through the social bookmarking website delicious.com. Just tag your links with Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of Showbiz Sandbox is by the popular indie group MGMT. You can visit their website at whoismgmt.com or find them at MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT. If you want to see the band in person, you'll have to be in Europe this week because on the 25th, they're playing Ibiza Rocks Hotel, which is in San Antonio, Spain. And on the 28th, they're flying to Stockholm, Sweden to play the Propaganda Festival before going to Paris, France, where they will play Rock Insane on August 30th, 2009. And thank you very much for joining us. Michael, thank you very much. Karen, who's not here, thank you very much. Until next week, play nice.